Chapter 13. White man could find his way. White men were strong, but very foolish. It was undesirable to fight them, but deception was easy. They were like silly women. They did not know the use of reason, and he was a match for any of them, went on Babalatchi, with all the confidence of deficient experience. Probably the Dutch would seek Elmer. Maybe they would take away their countrymen, if they were suspicious of him. That would be good. After the Dutch went away, Lacamba and Dane would get the treasure without any trouble, and there would be one person less to share it. Did he not speak wisdom? Will Tu and Dane go to Bulangi's house till the danger is over? Go at once? Dane accepted this suggestion of going into hiding with a certain sense of conferring a favor upon Lacamba and the anxious statesman, but he met the proposal of going at once with a decided no, looking Babalatchi meaningly in the eye. The statesman sighed as a man accepting the inevitable would do, and pointed silently towards the other bank of the river. Dane bent his head slowly. "Yes, I am going there," he said. "Before the day comes?" asked Babalatchi. "I am going there now," answered Dane, decisively. "He or Anglanda will not be here before tomorrow night, perhaps, and I must tell Almayer of our arrangements." "No, Tuan. No, say nothing," protested Babalatchi. "We'll go over myself at sunrise, and let him know." "I will see," said Dane, preparing to go. The thunderstorm was recommencing outside, the heavy clouds hanging low overhead now. There was a constant rumble of distant thunder punctuated by the nearer sharp crashes, and in the continuous play of blue lightning the woods and the river showed fitfully, with all the elusive distinctness of detail characteristic of such a scene. Outside the door of the Raja's house, Dane and Babalatchi stood on the shaking veranda, as if dazed and stunned by the violence of the storm. They stood there amongst the cowering forms of the Raja's slaves and retainers seeking shelter from the rain, and Dane called aloud to his boatman, who responded with an unanimous "Ada, Tuan," while they looked uneasily at the river. "This is a great flood," shouted Babalatchi into Dane's ear. "The river is very angry. Look. Look at the drifting logs. Can you go?" Dane glanced doubtfully on the livid expanse of seething water bounded far away on the other side by the narrow black line of the forests. Suddenly, in a vivid white flash, the low point of land with the bending trees on it and Almayer's house leaped into view, flickered and disappeared. Dane pushed Babalatchi aside, and ran down to the water gate followed by his shivering boatman. Babalatchi backed slowly in, and closed the door, then turned round and looked silently upon Lacamba. The Raja sat still, glaring stonily upon the table, and Babalatchi gazed curiously at the perplexed mood of the man he had served so many years through good and evil fortune. No doubt the one-eyed statesman felt within his savage and much sophisticated breast the unwonted feelings of sympathy with, and perhaps even pity for, the man he called his master. From the safe position of a confidential adviser, he could, in the dim vista of past years, see himself a casual cutthroat finding shelter under that man's roof in the modest rice clearing of early beginnings. Then came a long period of unbroken success, of wise counsels, and deep plottings resolutely carried out by the fearless Lacamba, till the whole east coast from Paolo La to Tanjong Badu listened to Babalatchi's wisdom speaking through the mouth of the ruler of Sambor. In those long years how many dangers escaped, how many enemies bravely faced, how many white men successfully circumvented. And now he looked upon the result of so many years of patient toil. The fearless Lacamba cowed by the shadow of an impending trouble. The ruler was growing old, and Babalatchi, aware of an uneasy feeling at the pit of his stomach, put both his hands there with a suddenly vivid and sad perception of the fact that he himself was growing old too. That the time of reckless daring was past for both of them, and that they had to seek refuge in prudent cunning. They wanted peace, they were disposed to reform, they were ready even to retrench, so as to have the wherewithal to bribe the evil days away, if bribed away they could be. Babalichai sighed for the second time that night as he squatted again at his master's feet, and tendered him his betel nut box in mute sympathy. And they sat there in close, yet silent communion of betel nut chewers, moving their jaws slowly, expectorating decorously into the wide-mouthed brass vessel they passed to one another, and listening to the awful din of the battling elements outside. There is a very great flood, remarked Babalachi, sadly. Yes, said Lakamba. It didn't go? He went, Tuan. He ran down to the river like a man possessed of the Sheetan himself. There was another long pause. He may get drowned, suggested Lakamba at last, with some show of interest. The floating logs are many, answered Babalachi, but he is a good swimmer, he added languidly. He ought to live, said Lakamba. He knows where the treasure is. Babalachi assented with an ill-humored grunt. His want of success in penetrating the white man's secret, as to the locality where the gold was to be found, was a sore point with the statesmen of Sambar, as the only conspicuous failure in an otherwise brilliant career. A great peace had now succeeded the turmoil of the storm. Only the little belated clouds, which hurried past overhead to catch up the main body flashing silently in the distance, sent down short showers that pattered softly with a soothing hiss over the palm leaf roof. Lakamba roused himself from his apathy with an appearance of having grasped the situation at last. Babalachi, he called briskly, giving him a slight kick. Adatuan, I am listening. If the Orang Blanda come here, Babalachi, and take Almayer to Batavia, to punish him for smuggling gunpowder, what will he do, you think? I do not know, Tuan. You are a fool, commented Lakamba, exultingly. He will tell him where the treasure is, so as to find mercy. He will. Babalachi looked up at his master, and nodded his head with by no means a joyful surprise. He had not thought of this. There was a new complication. Almayer must die, said Lakamba, decisively, to make our secret safe. He must die quietly, Babalachi. You must do it. Babalachi assented, and rose wearily to his feet. O Moro, he asked. Yes, before the Dutch come. He drinks much coffee, answered Lakamba, with seeming irrelevancy. Babalachi stretched himself yawning, but Lakamba, in the flattering consciousness of a knotty problem solved by his own unaided intellectual efforts, grew suddenly very wakeful. Babalachi, he said to the exhausted statesman, fetch the box of music the white captain gave me. I cannot sleep. At this order a deep shade of melancholy settled upon Babalachi's features. He went reluctantly behind the curtain, and soon reappeared carrying in his arms a small hand organ, which he put down on the table with an air of deep dejection. Lakamba settled himself comfortably in his armchair. Turn, Babalachi, turn, he murmured, with closed eyes. Babalachi's hand grasped the handle with the energy of despair, and as he turned, the deep gloom on his countenance changed into an expression of hopeless resignation. Through the open shutter the notes of Verdi's music floated out on the great silence over the river and forest. Lakamba listened with closed eyes and a delighted smile. Babalachi turned, at times dozing off and swaying over, then catching himself up in a great fright with a few quick turns of the handle. Nature slept in an exhausted repose after the fierce turmoil, while under the unsteady hand of the statesman of Sambar the trovador fitfully wept, wailed, and bade goodbye to his Leonor again and again in a mournful round of tearful and endless iteration. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.